Well, anyone in a years-long relationship can tell you that intimacy can and will change. But with some patience and some compassion, you know, couples can find that closeness again. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. And joining us today is certified relationship and sex therapist Margaret Berg, whose private practice, Margaret Berg Therapy, is located in Madison. Margaret has nearly 30 years of experience helping couples work through issues relating to intimacy, and we'd like you to join in the conversation. Don't be shy. How do you and your partner stay connected and emotionally in tune with one another? Do you want advice on how to fan the flames of passion after so many years together? Who writes this stuff? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Margaret, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. 30 years, my gosh, you look like you're 25, so.
Thank you.
Are you sure you've had 30 years? Because, you know, we want to make sure that we have all the best people here.
Not quite 30 years.
Not quite. Okay, see, I knew it.
Yes,
I knew it,
yes. So. It says nearly on there.
Yeah. So, yes. So why do intimacy change in our relationships? What are some of the factors that fall into that?
Well, if you're comparing a long-term committed relationship, that's going to be different, feel different than someone like a friend with benefits or mm-hmm. a fair partner or a short-term partner, a couple months or maybe even a year. It is theorized that the romantic stage of a relationship lasts anywhere from 2 hours is kind of the joke, but 2 months to maybe a year and a half before the power struggle sets in.
Sure.
And most folks feel like when they're in the power struggle that that's the end, and people might say, oh, I need to find a new partner, or you're not the person I thought I fell in love with, or who is this person? Mm-hmm. Like, you have totally changed. And really nothing's changed. You've just kind of gone back to baseline, because in the beginning of all our new relationships, we have new relationship energy. We have our brains are being drenched with neurotransmitter. There's a little like cocktail bartender in our brain that's like going, ooh, here's a little dopamine.
Right.
Yeah. You know, here's some oxytocin. Mm-hmm. Here's some norepinephrine. And so it feels really, really, really good. But we can't be in that place forever. Mm-hmm. And so usually people will find a new partner, but then they'll find that, oh, I'm ending up in the same pattern of relationship that happened the last time. I tried to consciously pick a very different person. I was set out to do it. I for sure thought I did. But now I'm actually feeling similar losses, similar unmet needs that mm-hmm. I was having in my relationship before. Why is that? That's because we all are not told that we have to go through the power struggle to get to a real love stage. And in the beginning, most partners are not having to talk about sex and intimacy. It's just happening. You're just colliding into each other and things are just kind of taking care of themselves. And there's this myth that, you know, it's spontaneous, but it's really not. You're thinking about sex all the time. You're thinking about when you're going to get it with that person. You're thinking about, ooh, what panties am I going to wear tonight? Or, you know, what cologne can I wear? Or like, you're planning things out all the time and people have this like fantasy that, oh, it's just happening. So when the power struggle happens, it's actually a gift to growing up and becoming mature and needing to communicate. And most of us didn't grow up with models that talked about sex, that talked about, hey, come talk to me. Do you have any questions? We had models that were more shaming or driven by religion. And so most of us can't get around shame with sex and sexuality, and it feels dark and it feels heavy mm-hmm. and we feel alone so much. And we just want to feel connected with the other. And we have no model for inviting us to talk about it. And it's really, really difficult.
Right. And a lot of this gets unsaid. So then what does that do when you've got these wants or needs or what have you, and you don't tell your partner?
Well, a lot of things can happen. You can choose to have like a parallel relationship and just not be connected to your joy and aliveness. And maybe find that through your children or friends or work or other exits in your life where you're finding joy. You might get a divorce and you might have an affair. You might open up your partnership to find it with perhaps somebody else as well. Or you might decide to talk about it. That's probably the most difficult, most challenging, most vulnerable route to go, is to talk about it, to find someone to help support you in it if you can't do it alone. And it's hard work. Mm-hmm. It is hard work. It's a vulnerable process, but when you're with someone and you're next to someone, you know, naked or clothed, and they're revealing themselves, you're being a safe enough object to allow them to fully emerge and express themselves. And I'm getting tearful because this work is very spiritual to me. Mm-hmm. And it's like at our essence, it's part of our life force, is where our spirit and our sex kind of just collide. And it's very connected to how we move in the world, is if we are connected to how we're feeling sexually or our sexual self-confidence or, and it can look so different for everybody. But we have these very, you know, minimal sexual stereotypes that have been around that are just very old and are not helpful and keep us in this place where we feel very inadequate and not alive. And we judge ourselves on other people or other relationships. And we really need to just talk more with our partner and see what they're thinking, because we're not sharing most of the time what our needs are.
And it's a very scary place to be for most people.
Yes.
To reveal themselves like that. Now, how do men and women express, you know, this dissatisfaction with a relationship differently? Because I'm pretty sure most of them do, right?
Well, I would say most of it might come out in a defensive pattern, is how someone might express it, no matter what genitals you have, what gender you have.
Okay.
If you're feeling hurt and you don't feel safe to share, it comes out in a defensive pattern of blaming, shaming, criticizing, not curiosity, not wonder, like, oh, I wonder, like, you know, most people aren't great sexual intimate teams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to, like, take something on. It's easier to blame and point a finger. And if something's going on in someone's sexual relationship and you're partnered, you're not on an island by yourself. You know, this is, you're a team and you're a system.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a challenge coming up, both of you have something to learn, to grow into, to stretch into, to reclaim from maybe childhood or some sort of heavy blanket that's on there that needs to be lifted so you can be invited into a different place to emerge. Mm-hmm. Or to heal. You know, a lot of us are, there's a lot of pain with sexuality, a lot of non-consent that happens when we're younger, when we're adults. And if you don't have a voice, which a lot of us aren't taught that it's okay to have a voice in our family system, sex or not, it's just not safe. And so you can't expect someone to come out and be open and vulnerable when they don't even have permission to use a voice. Or they might be projecting that. You know, maybe their partner's open to it, but they're projecting that into the space. Well, I didn't have one before, so I'm assuming it's not safe to have one now. So I'm just going to be quiet over here. I'm going to accept the little crumbs that I get. Or, you know, a lot of folks don't want to have sex because the sex that they're having is just not worth wanting.
Yeah.
And that's not their partner's fault.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a responsibility to ourselves. Our arousal and our orgasm, if we choose to have one or have had one or know how to have one, it is our responsibility. It is never our partner's responsibility, our arousal, our desire, our orgasm. But that's not the model we're taught with,
that's
right?
That's huge, because
women are taught to please all the time. And I meet so many women in their 40s or 50s who are like, I can't say the F word, but they're like, F that. Like, and they come in and then their partner, who they've been with for a while, they're like, what's going on? I thought everything was okay.
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking a heteronormative couple here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no, I want something more. I want something different. And that's just, it's so exciting when that happens. It's such hard work when that happens. But there's like a shift that occurs. And then there's like hope. And there's something to gain and learn for, if you're talking about a heterosexual couple, the male-bodied person in this scenario as well. And this can happen in any gendered couple. There's always going to be, in any gendered couple, someone that has a higher desire for physical sex, someone that has a higher desire to keep gas in the tank, someone that has a higher desire to close the door when they're going to the bathroom, whatever it might be. It's no different with sex, but sex is just so sensationalized, and we have to create it, and advertising makes so much money off of making people feel inadequate about it, and it's just, it's sad.
Yeah, it is, really, because people are missing a huge part of what makes us human, right? This touch, this, you know, connection. So, excuse me, for those who have not had any kind of therapy or have been exposed to anything like this, what would a session look like? So, you know, if someone comes to you, their, you know, the partners come to you, what happens at first?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, all living organisms thrive with safety. Mm-hmm. So it's up to me to create like a safe container for whoever's coming into the room, whether they're an individual or a couple. But we'll just talk about couples right now.
Mm-hmm.
We start with breath work. We start with getting grounded. We start with positivity. When we're with our partner long enough, we start flagging for negatives. We have a whole file on them, like, ooh, I saw you do that. I'm going to put that in there. Just wait till I pull that out later. And so we need to really start being positive. We start every session with an intention. How do I want this to go? How do I want to show up? We take responsibility. We have some skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So you're creating an intimate team feeling. I have people share an appreciation for themselves or their partner in the beginning, and then we go from there. We use the Imago dialogue as a basis of grounding and connecting and feeling safe with one another. So it's a conversation, a give and take. It allows the brain to slow down, to not make up all these stories. It allows you to focus on your partner, to cut off your head and your ego and go over to their island and be a little curious about their experience, because we have this kind of symbiotic disillusion with our partners that they are supposed to know what we want and what we feel. And you know, if we didn't get that met in childhood, that need is still going unmet now, and but we're not conscious of it, and we expect our partners to provide that for us.
Mm-hmm.
Without opening our mouths, without expressing a need. And if we're not getting a need met by our partner, it's not because they don't want to give it to us, it's because they do not know how. And so we have to have so much compassion and curiosity about that. So that's what we begin with. We begin with positivity. We begin with getting a sense of, like, you and I are a team. I'm just really holding space for whatever needs to come out, to come out. I do embodied work as well. So I invite clients into their bodies and noticing and just really slowing down and paying attention to facial expressions, to tone of voice changes, to like, oh, what was that? What do you think that's about? Or, you know, just anything, because so often we're just in autopilot and we are missing out in present moment vital experiences that make us alive, make mm-hmm. us feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel numbed out. And then we go to these other things that we think aren't going to help the numbness, which aren't usually helpful for us sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're missing that vitality, that connection right in front of us,
right,
we just don't know. We don't have a great roadmap there, because most of our models weren't fantastic.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Margaret Berg. She's a certified relationship and sex therapist and a workshop presenter. What do you want to know about couples therapy? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So as we age, our bodies change, obviously. How do you help people get past that, Margaret?
Well, I think it goes like even before that, our like kind of paradigm or lens of like what we think sex is. And we tend to grow up learning that, you know, sex is intercourse, and it includes a penis and a vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And it leaves out a whole other human race of people that end up being marginalized, and these sets of expectations, this kind of pass-fail scenario, and leaves a lot of people feeling inadequate. And it's interesting, Peggy Kleinplatz did this amazing study on optimal sexual experiences, and many of the people talked about how their favorite experiences where they felt most alive was when they were like fumbling around when they were in adolescence, before any kind of penetration of any sort of any genitals or body parts were going on. And just that space of playfulness and creativity and maybe, ooh, we might get caught, and the, you know, illicitness that goes on with that. And so often when we're with someone, we get into this routine. First we do this, then we do this, then we do this. And then we might get old enough that actually that's not working any longer. And then a lot of people will just stop being sexual. And it's very sad. We're sexual when we're in utero. They find children touching their genitals for self-soothing in utero. And children go to their genitals when they're younger to touch because it feels good. Before children are self-pleasuring or masturbating, they're touching their genitals because it feels good. When they're sick, they touch their genitals. And sorry, I just lost my train of thought. I'm like, I'm immersed in like self-pleasure right now. Woo! No, but we have this model of what sex is. And so it's really important to expand that. And especially as we age and as parts of our bodies aren't showing up as we want them to or mm-hmm. as we expect them to. So we really need to change our expectations. And no matter, I mean, it could happen earlier on. It could be a medicine that we're on. It could be a surgery that we had. It could be post breast cancer, or, you know, it can be vulvar pain. You know, so many people just stop having sex because of this very limited model about what we learn pleasure looks like. And it's so important to go throughout your day of allowing yourself little moments of pleasure that have nothing to do with sex, that have to do with sensory experiences and sensuality, because those are the building blocks for when you're not walking around horny, which a lot of women in long-term relationships, and some men as well, are not. That's just the norm. That doesn't mean anyone's broken or your partner doesn't love you or find you attractive anymore. That's just the norm. Mm-hmm. That's called responsive desire. Mm-hmm. We're no longer walking around with this spontaneous model. And it doesn't mean we're in the wrong relationship or you have the wrong partner. It just means you actually have to communicate more.
Sure. Now, what is this good enough sex model that I've heard about?
Yeah, so the Good Enough Sex Model was created by Barry McCarthy, Dr. Barry McCarthy, and Dr. Michael Metz. And it's kind of focuses on positive psychology and gender equity, going from like what we learned about sex and sexual arousal models of like male sexual response. Masters and Johnson's back in the 60s was based on a male. Mm-hmm. You know, there's four phases. There's like all of a sudden there's this, you're already excited, right? There's this erection. Uh-huh. And then you have this orgasm or plateau. You have a refractory period, and maybe you are young enough and vital enough and whatever enough that you go and have this experience again. That's, and then they placed women on top of that. And that's a lot of research, unfortunately, is compiled like that. Mm-hmm. So, the Good Enough Sex Model was, I think Barry and Michael were of older age when they came up with it. And it's going away from a pass-fail sexual experience to really opening up the space for playfulness, for, you know what, sometimes we're not going to have the same experience. A lot of couples will come and say, hey, we want to have an orgasm at the same time. And sometimes I'm like, why? If you're worried about someone else's orgasm and focusing on like them having an orgasm at the same time, like you're losing out on your own arousal. Like I'm selfish. I'm like, I want to be yummy in my own experience. I'm like, if you want to like time yours on mine, go for it, you know. But you know, but that was part of like what I grew up with as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we have, you know, in men earlier, by the way, sorry I missed out on male bodied folks, but they are taught too that they're supposed to be the end all be all, like make a woman have an orgasm, and they're not, you know, they're machismo, and, you know, and so, you know, it's these unfair models. So the Good Enough Sex Model just talks about a lot of just breaking through the myths that we all grow up with. And it's based on, you know, more sexual facts and clear evidence-based sexual education that's given in the model, that people feel more refreshed, connected, mm-hmm. Variable sexual experiences are okay. If one person or nobody has an orgasm, that's okay. The only goal is this pleasure oriented sex that we're going to have. Let's play, let's get naked and play, or maybe not, we're not naked. Let's just be sensual and play. You know, that can be sex. It's okay. But if you wanted to look it up, you know, there's, you know, so many tenets I could go on for hours and talk about it. But it's a lovely, compassionate model versus, you know, kind of what we're stuck with in our head, what we judge ourselves on, and which keeps us from a lot of pleasure.
So basically you're saying that this idea of intimacy, we've been kind of conditioned to think it's this small little thing. This is what we have to do to be intimate. But in reality, it's much broader and there's a lot more things involved. Is that, am I getting that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And it starts way before you're doing anything sexually technical.
Okay.
It starts in the relationship. Mm-hmm. Do I feel cherished by you?
Yeah.
Do I feel safe with you? Do I feel like you have my back?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all prerequisites to inviting someone to fully emerge, to be let go, to have personal risk-taking in bed, to actually have a healing, transformative experience through sexual intimacy, to have a transcendent experience, to let go of time and just, you know, giggle or cry or just not, just for any outcome to be okay, because that's you and I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And
so what are some of the tools and strategies that you give couples to help them reconnect, you know, on this more intimate level?
So many.
What are the basics? I mean, if I was coming to you the first time out, what would you do? What would you tell us?
Well, I probably wouldn't give you anything the first time out,
okay,
because I would have to I would have to ask you a lot of questions.
Okay.
So I knew I wasn't going to do any damage and invite you into a place that you weren't ready for.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Joel about this, how, like, you know, sensationalizing sex, Netflix shows, HBO, like, you know, these kinds of things, and it's, you know, you really need to be careful because they're editing a lot out of the micro steps that are needed for connection and for growth and for safety to go to those places. And so before I assign anything or invite people into anything, I need to establish that I'm not going to do any harm.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, I give folks some bonding behaviors. There are 31 ways of being connected with one another that are sensual ways. They're little invitations of not being sexual. They have value just in themselves. They could take anywhere from 10 minutes to a half hour. The goal is not to get anybody revved up and ready for something, which is a lot of what some partners can feel and frankly are very turned off by. Sometimes I'll just ask people to start making out again. Because what I find is couples will stop making out. One partner might stop making out because they think it's going to lead to intercourse. And they don't want it to lead it. They just want some yummy time.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know how to share that. They're afraid of hurting their partner's feelings or afraid of hurting their partner's self-esteem. And so they don't do anything. Or they might decide to, like, forego the make out. And then they have intercourse. And it's a chore. And they're lying there. And they're just this vessel. And none of us want to be having any kind of intimacy with just a vessel. And they're not getting much out of it. We can tell if our partner, you know, really wants to be there or not. And so, you know, our partners really need to have the ability to say no when they want to say no. So they can have this exciting yes. And then you can be there for it, to witness it, to feel it, to experience it. But you have to be able to self-soothe. Every time your partner says no, I'm not in the mood, you can't act like a five-year-old.
Right.
You can't pout. You can't decide not to pick up the kids from soccer. You say, you know, blah, da, 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 da. You know, that's passive aggressive. It's immature. And you need to grow up. And you need to have a discussion about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, if they were saying yes, they would feel like what was going on was good. And they felt safe. And, you know, and again, you're both a team. The other partner's responsibility is to share what they're needing and wanting if they're not getting it. As difficult as it may be, you have to take little steps. And it might take a long time, but it's worth it. It's worth feeling alive and connected and joyful and satisfied. And that satisfied, again, is not one way. Satisfaction can look so many different ways. It's very variable from one person to another, from one gender to another.
We're almost done, actually, with our half an hour. It went so quickly. But I know that a few times a year, you and your husband, Jason Eisenberg, facilitate intimacy workshops for couples. What are these workshops like? Is this like a weekend, or what's the basis on that?
So we facilitate two types of workshops. One is a three-hour mini intimacy workshop where it's here in Madison. It's at the Quarry Arts Building where my private practice is. And it's limited to 8 couples, and we use the Imago Dialogue as a safety structure to discuss and move into, invite you into talking about intimacy, and we are very pleasure-oriented and not goal-directed, so it's very playful. There's sensual music. We do lots of breath work. You know, one of the components of Peggy Kleinpatt's work is being present and embodied and using your breath. If we aren't relaxed, we cannot have blood flow to our genitals. And to have more blood flow to our genitals, we feel more arousal. And so if we're anxious, we can't have blood flow to our genitals. So our intimacy workshops are very playful. And then our long weekend Imago relationship workshops, that's coming up in November, mm-hmm. and also at the Christine Center in January. And those are based on the Imago Getting the Love You Want weekend workshop.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Margaret. We really, really appreciate you coming in. Margaret Berg is a certified relationship and sex therapist and workshop presenter.